Smestions.
Hey, it's take three.
Oh, wow.
What?
It was a bit of a start.
Davin Bunbury, I've lost track of all the people you've been told you look like. Can you list them all, please?
Is this the both of us, right?
Yes, it's both of us. I mean, I think this is more of a you question than a me question, because I don't think I've been confused with many people. I think I'm heading towards Christopher Walken.
Yeah, you've got a bit of a Christopher Walken.
And
you should do a radio show called Christopher Walken Talkin'.
And Zoe Ball once said to me, you look like an old Brad Pitt. Which, to be honest, I took as a compliment.
Yes, I
But it's completely wrong. Now, you are Mark Lamar.
Oh, and Charles Hawtrey.
Charles Hawtrey,
Charles Hawtrey in the Ork. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, we were Hawtrey in the Ork.
Yeah, so I have gone from, in my, if you saw the feature when I finished my tenure at The Observer, they did a movie poster thing of my 10 years, and they did a picture in which they were trying to make me look like James Dean. And that was very sweet of them, because when I was younger, I really wanted to look like James Dean. When I was in my 20s, I was a dead ringer for Jesse Birdsall, to the point that I have... Jesse Birdsall is an actor, and rocking as well. And he was in that TV series Annika, and then he was in El Dorado, which my mother really liked. And then I went to a hotel in Edinburgh. I've told this story before, I'll tell it again. I went to a hotel in Edinburgh for the Edinburgh Film Festival, and I walked in and I sat down, and the concierge came up to me and he said, oh, it's wonderful to have you back. And I went, oh, it's nice. I hadn't been there before. And he said, would you like a coffee on the house? And I went, yeah, great. You know, I thought I'm more famous than I thought I was. And then he came over and then he said, I just want to say I was absolutely devastated when El Dorado was cancelled. And I said, oh, I'm not Jesse Birdsall. He went, of course you're not, sir. And then he went off and then he came back with the, and he said, would you mind? And I thought, all right then. So I signed Jesse Birdsall's autograph. And then when I met Jesse Birdsall years later, I told him, I have signed autographs as you. So there was that. And now, then I looked like Richard Nixon for many years. Mm. And now I look like the old guy from Up.
Yeah, okay.
That's quite the trajectory.
Michael
Gove, you horrible person.
Nasty, brutish and short.
Nasty, brutish and short.
Very good. Okay, so thank you very much for those. This is Rob. Messing up my timings a few weeks ago, I turned up to see Oppenheimer and was let into an empty and just cleaned auditorium where the tail end of Mission Impossible's credits were still running. While I was reappreciating the music, which I'm sure has featured on Scala.
It has.
I noticed a disclaimer towards the end which confirmed that no cars were driven up or down the Spanish Steps at any point. I.e. the same sort of wording used to reassure us that no animals were harmed and so on. Mm. Is this a new thing? Do we now have to be informed about the way locations have been used? Was there a similar disclaimer about all known London landmarks in that Gerard Butler escapade? Did you notice that?
Did I notice that?
That there was a thing that said no cars were driven up or down the Spanish Steps at any point.
Yes, I did.
I mean, but is that a new thing? That's the question.
Yes, it'll be, I did notice it, and it will be because people being alarmed that you were actually damaging the Spanish Steps. I did notice that they had that disclaimer at the end, yes.
I wonder if that's ever been used before, you know, that I know we've blown up the White House,
but we didn't actually blow it up. Yeah.
If you've seen something similar, let us know. correspondence@conamo.com.
Can I just show you this? This has just come in.
I haven't finished Rob's email.
Oh, sorry, finish that, then I'll tell
you. Rob says, way back around the start of this feature.
Oh, yes, okay.
I think you were asked about books you hadn't read, and Mark sounded rather guilty about Spencer's Fairy Queen. Feeling similarly at the time, I knew Fairy Queen was long, but it seemed like one of those things that ought to be undertaken. I got started and can honestly thoroughly recommend the experience if Mark wants to give it a try. What particularly worked was an adoption of Simon's Avatar 2 viewing strategy. I... alternating it.
Yes, that's right. Well, which movies did you watch?
John Wick. I was alternating Avatar with John Wick. I alternated each of Spencer's six or seven books with undemanding, fast-paced action. Sharp novels work for me. Anyway, I kept the momentum going, thinking that it rather suits the Fairy Queen, which has its fair share of elaborate slashings and hackings, albeit in strict meter. Anyway, just a recommendation. It's never too late for these things.
Very good.
You wanted to say.
I'm sorry. This is why I got distracted, because I got my computer open and I got an email alert. This is the level that we're at. They have just sent me an email alert for a screening of The Exorcist Believer.
The Exorcist.
The Exorcist.
Maybe it's a new department.
Wow. They're really throwing everything behind this. Oh.
Okay. Now explain what you've just been told.
Simon Paul just said, have you seen how long the drinks reception before the screening is? There's a drinks reception at 5:30 and the screening starts at 7:15.
Wow.
That means you're going to be slammed by the time you get in to see The Exorcist Believer. Do you think they'd run the drinks thing as a test thing before they wrote, just another thing, the multimedia screening The Exorcist Believer.
Maybe
how hard can it be to spell Exorcist?
Oh, here's an interesting one from Paul. Simon and Mark, LTL and NRE, which means never read out email.
Oh, okay.
So he has contributed, but okay, nothing's ever got on before. I have a question primarily directed at Simon, but I think it does involve you. I have just finished a rather good book called Knife Edge by some author called Simon Mayo. But I actually borrowed this book from the library.
Oh, okay.
My question is, do libraries work the same way as music streaming sites? E.g., for every usage of the track, a very small sum is paid to the owner of that song, or do libraries work differently, say with no money being paid to the author after the original purchase of the book? I'm just interested to see if you receive any payment for me reading your book, which bizarrely, just before going through the questions and schmestions, I was corresponding with a woman from the PLR, British Library Public Lending Right. So they define them, so you can follow them X. Public lending right is every author's legal right to be remunerated when their books are borrowed freely from public libraries. I have to say, the process by which you register is so complicated that I've almost given up. I keep sending it in and sending them information and ticking this and sending all that. Then they message back saying, you haven't finished it. And I say, I have finished it. I've got to the end. I've sent it in. No, you haven't. So then I do it again. And then they say, no, you still haven't finished it. So I'm on the verge of giving up. But the answer to your question, Paul, is as long as the author has registered with PLR, every time your book is borrowed, so if you want to get Hatchet Job out of the library, if Mark has registered with PLR.
Not.
Okay, well, in which case, Mark will not get any money. But if you register, then every time your book is borrowed, you get money.
The only thing I know is, and this is just because it's an academic thing, is that if you photocopy pages of a book, you get a residual, because my books are in like the British BFI library and things. So if somebody photocopies 10 pages of my books, register
that
them.
Fair.
Yeah, and then the BFI, you get something like 10p or something. But that is specifically to do with photocopying. It never occurred to me that somebody would pay money for borrowing a book out of a library and reading it.
I only found out about this, you know, comparatively recently. But you should this is very specifically aimed at you.
Okay, fine.
If you've written a book, you should register with the British Library Public Lending Right, because you.
Or I should just go, you know, if somebody wants to, on the unthinkable off chance that somebody goes into a library and says, I'd like to read a book by that annoying film critic off of the pod.
What's interesting, whose money is it?
I don't know. I've got no idea.
No, but I shall correspond again with the British Library. Just say, must be the British Library then, presumably. If I have to register with them for a book, presumably.
No, I mean, I know in terms of music licensing. So if you, like, for example, this isn't just to flag up that the Dodge Brothers have just recorded a Christmas record.
What's it called?
It's called the Dodge Brothers Christmas EP.
That's quite memorable.
Yeah. We may change the title.
What songs are on there?
I Can't Wait for Christmas, which is an original.
Yeah.
Don't Shoot It, Santa, which is an original.
Yeah.
Oh, we have done, I'm Going to Trim Your Tree, which is very, very racy.
Is it?
Very, very racy.
Do they all sound fairly similar?
No.
No, they're very different.
No, they all sound very, very different.
Okay,
they all sound
good.
Very different. Anyway.
I'm looking forward to that. And then I'm going to buy a copy, and then will you get some money?
Yeah, so the way it works is, if you record something and then it's available on streaming services and blah, 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 Ali, who is in charge of the band, then has to go through this incredibly complicated process of registering all the different bits. So the publishing rights, as in the songwriting rights, the mechanical rights, as in the actual mechanical rights of playing the thing. And it gets more and more complicated. And each bit of this information is embedded in is it called microdata?
Could be.
So that, you know, like, if you played a CD, well, nobody plays CDs anymore, do they? Well, I do, but it should be, all the information should be on the CD. But certainly if you go to Spotify and things, it's got to have all these different things. And then PRS, which is Performing Rights Society, at the end of the year or four times a year, you get a certain amount of money. And what they do is they either pay you for the stuff that you've written that's been played on the radio or has been played in, or you get the sum of money that they've collected divided by everyone in PRS.
I mean, Tuppence Halfpenny, isn't it,
yeah,
really, by
eight
the
quid.
End of the day?
£8.
£8.
But although, okay. Except the one time that I did get a big check was when I wrote the theme tune and the interstitial music for Danny Baker After All back in the 90s. And that series seemed to have got sold around the world. And then I ended up getting a check that was big enough to buy an electric guitar with. Because the good lady Professor Herring Dawe said, you're never going to get a check that big ever again.
Charlotte Pink says, if you could have a conversation with any animal, which one would you choose and why? Now, I don't know from Charlotte whether she name a specific animal or whether she means if there is there a type of animal? Okay. If you could talk to a type of animal, what would you do?
Okay.
Imagine chatting with a chimp in Chimpanzee.
Which song is that?
Imagine talking to a tiger.
Which song is it?
If I could talk to the animals.
The animals, of course it is. Okay. Can I go
to Doolittle?
Can I go first on this?
Yes, you can.
Because I got a very, very specific answer.
Yes.
Okay. If I could talk to an animal, right?
Singular, yeah.
Singular. I would like to talk to our cat, Bella. And I would like to say, Bella, why are you so scared of me? See, Bella had a really, really horrible start in life. We got her as a rescue. She was a kitten. She was dumped in a dog poo bin by some horrible person. And she was rescued. And she, it always happened. She'd turn up at the vet and the vet would ring and say, would you like another cat? We go, no. And then they'd send us a photograph. We go, all
yes.
Right. So Bella then arrived at our house and she is absolutely terrified of me, but not of the good lady professor. And so what happens is my entire interaction with Bella consists of, and I'm this is exactly what happens. I wake up in the morning, 5 o'clock, okay? I get up, I go to the bathroom. I come back from the bathroom. And as I come back from the bathroom, yeah. Bella, who has been waiting outside in the hall all night for me to leave, goes in, snuggles with the good lady professor indoors, then hears me coming down the corridor and legs it out of the thing and is gone. And then I don't see her again. And I've lived with this cat now for 3 years and I have seen her only at top speed.
I think you've answered your own question. I think you represent everything that went wrong for her
before.
And it's not your fault. But she sees you as the figure that dumped her in the play thing in the first place.
And I want to go, Bella.
It's me.
It's me. I like you. I'm, you know.
I used to write in The Observer, but I don't anymore.
Yeah, who do you think paid to have your foot fixed when you fell out of that tree? You know, it was like not the person that put you in the poo bin.
Yeah. I would. I mean, my guess is everyone is going to answer this in exactly the same way. And if they'll pick an animal that they know.
Yes.
So the only dog in our life is Lyra. Lyra the Schneegel, cross between a schnauzer and a beagle, who lives in Copenhagen with child one, fiancé one, and grandson one. And
you're going to have to think of names for them.
I know. It's a fabulous dog. But, you know, I would quite like to, you know, if you could have a conversation, you're thinking, what's it like? You would just love to have that conversation because she always looks exactly the same because they don't have expressions.
There's a bit of film that you sent me of Lyra when you had been looking after Lyra and child one came back from some round the world jaunt.
Yeah, no, he'd been working in the DRC.
And Lyra nearly exploded.
Oh, she goes crazy. Delight.
I mean, it was insane. I mean, it was like it was a comedy.
She does an excitement wee on the floor, which is what she always does. And she goes round and round in circles, excitement wee, round and round in circles, excitement wee, yelping, what? Jumping up and down, finding something, a little cushion. I'm going to bring you a cushion. Oh no, I've done a wee on that as well. Anyway, it's a problem we all have.
We have with our dog, the first thing that you have to do whenever you come back home is she has to come outside first because otherwise she will excitement wee on the...
Alana says, if you could name the first city on Mars, what would you name it?
Well, I'd like to call it
Watney's Red Planet.
Which I'm sorry, but it's your joke. Watneyville.
Yeah, or given that Mars is the god of war,
yeah,
you could call it Peacetown.
Oh, that's good.
And then it would just be like, we're reclaiming our own planet.
Yeah, okay.
Work, rest and play, because it's the other Mars. Something like that.
Actually, that's it. Call it work, rest and play.
Or why don't you call it Matt Damon?
They aren't allowed to say that anymore, are they? A Mars a day helps you work, rest and play, because apparently it's not true.
Although sugar kind of gives you energy, so I don't see why you can't claim that.
How does it help you rest?
Well, because...
You get sugar rush and then you get sugar crash.
Yeah, that's right. The Mars bar's worked its magic and so you have a kip. Okay, so here's the question that I've been thinking about the most.
Okay.
From Jean in Tampa. It's a very short question, as all the best questions are. What type of people are you scared of? So in the way that I remember from history exams and essays that you write, I'm paying particular attention to her phrasing.
Okay.
So which type of people are you scared of? So this is not... See, scared to me sounds stronger than frightened, but obviously we're splitting hairs a bit, and certainly not worried about. So I'll give it to you first of all.
Yeah. I am scared, and it's interesting that you've used the word scared, not, you know, worried about, yeah, but scared, okay? I am scared of crowds, like properly scared of crowds. I find crowds really frightening. And I find them frightening because there is something to do with a group of people moving as one body that it really, really alarms me. I don't like being in festival crowds. I don't like being in packed gig crowds. I don't understand the thing about moshing. And I know people find it thrilling and exciting. And I know that the reason is because I'm basically quite paranoid. I find crowds really alarming to the point that I can't be in them. Luckily, I play in a band that have never played to a really, really big crowd, which is kind of, you know, encouraging. We like to keep our...
What about a crowded cinema? That counts as a crowd because everyone's sitting down.
Seated isn't. And of course, I would be a classic case of somebody who, you know, I've not been to a football match, but if I were, the idea of a terrace rather than a seat, I understand the seated thing. I know that, you know, long-standing football fans, you know, have a nostalgic memory of the terraces. No, I mean, seated is good. So crowds scare me. In terms of what type of person scares me, and I thought about this, because you kind of mentioned, you said this last night, and you said you'll go to bed thinking about it.
I just think it's the kind of question that you'd need to think about.
Okay, here's what I think. And this sounds slightly contradictory. The kind of person that I am scared of is charismatic people. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I am very, very scared by people who seem able to charm and mesmerize and appeal in a way that is, from my point of view, it's a dangerous power. And I'll give you an example. This isn't, I know it's not about a person, but for example, all the stuff with, you know, with Trump, whatever else you think about Trump, Trump is charismatic. And I think it's very dangerous that he's charismatic because I think people don't hear what he says is insane and like really properly unhinged, but he says it in a way that his followers, his MAGA followers believe. I think there are other examples of people in the news recently who have a kind of messianic edge and they have been talked about as being charismatic and therefore...
So you mean Russell Brand?
Yes. And I absolutely, fundamentally, whenever I see anything like that, I just think Charles Manson. I think there is something really scary about the power to... And it goes back to when I was younger and you'd hear about American televangelists. And we think this was the nuts. What, people go on the telly and do that stuff and you just ask for money. And I remember when Phil Collins had that song,
Jesus Knows Me.
And in the video, he was being a televangelist. And it was like a joke. But now it's everywhere. It's in mainstream politics. And it's the charismatic person and the rise of, you know, some podcasts and YouTube channels, charismatic individuals.
CEOs in companies are often... Yes. Charismatic people.
And here's the thing that I would say about it as well, and I say this after a couple of years of therapy. I also say it as a worry about myself. I'm not saying, hey, I'm a charismatic individual on those points, but I think that there are times when I have been, you know, people have said, oh, you know, he has... And I distrust it. I absolutely distrust it. I distrust the ability to win people over with specious, bogus arguments. And also because I associate it with, you know, there are men who are very charming and very dangerous. Those are the people that scare me. And they really, really scare me.
Can I ask you,
did that make sense?
I think that's a very, very, it goes into a very interesting area. And I think you're absolutely right. When you say charismatic people, are the people you're thinking of overwhelmingly male?
Yes.
I see. That's interesting. Anyway, I agree with it. I don't have the same problem with crowds, but I think charismatic people you do need to question them more cleverly, more smartly than your average person. So I'm thinking, who are the people I'm scared of? In a crowd, I would suggest that because there are lots of people who this is aimed at, it's the people who have easy answers, who see the world in a black and white sense, that everything is straightforward for them, that they don't realize that the world is very complicated. They are quick to blame, slow to understand. They just want to be told. That is often the way that leads into, you know whose fault it is. It's the blob. It's the metropolitan elite.
It's them.
It's them. It's the Jews. It's that. That's where it leads.
Yeah.
Because it's people who
mainstream media.
Yeah. All of that. So, and I think that one person like that you can deal with. When that's a crowd tapping into your crowd, that's scary.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. That is a really good question, not least because I don't feel that we fully answered it.
Jeannie Tampa, look.
It's very good.
If people want to chip in on all of these things, can people reply to these? Can they reply to
us? We can send us emails and we can read them out next week. Yeah. What type of
people are you scared of?
Yeah, I think it's a very good...
One more. This is a cinematic question. A long email, which I will paraphrase from Andy Rosier.
Okay.
It basically boils down to, he finally gets to the question, which is, what do you think movie production and consumption will look like in 20 years? That's what it boils down to. So he just says, in passing, the technology behind cinema has always leapt forward, some advances sticking, some not so much. Talkies, colour, camera equipment, digital projection have all taken cinema forward and become the norm. But different forms of 2-3-1 production, like CinemaScope, then 3D and media on laser discs, video CD, VHS tapes, even DVDs are fading out as new ways of consuming media are available. So he's saying, right, I've been looking at all this stuff. Mm-hmm. In 20 years, so that's the time frame. 20 years' time, movie production and movie consumption will look like what?
Okay. Obviously, my answer is a product of the time that I am in, okay? My feeling has always been that after we arrived at color, stereo, widescreen, that essentially the parameters of cinema had been defined. Now, obviously, there were ways of tweaking that. Stereo could become 5.1 and surround and all the rest of it. And projection could go from IMAX to digital to, you know, whatever. There were different ways of, you know, click. But essentially, it is still the same thing that you have the possibility of color. You have the image that is wide enough to fit the viewing of the human eye, because 2-3-5 exists for a reason, and it's to do with kind of peripheral vision, after which you start getting into, you know, rods and cones and all that stuff. So I think that there is a kind of platonic ideal of cinema, which is that, and it's not saying color rather than black and white, but just the possibility for color in 2-3-5 with at least stereo sound, although no reason why you can't make a, you know, mono thing, and you can make a silent film. But that's it. And that everything else, 3D, 4DX, it's all... That isn't advancing it any further. And I think that that's what cinema is. Now, it may be that we're, because of, particularly with gaming, computer gaming, that virtual reality is taking on a form of its own, and it may even become the dominant entertainment medium.
So we're not in the cinema now, we're at home, but we have the option of putting on...
But what I'm saying is that's not cinema. I'm saying, I think cinema will look very much like what it looks like now. Because I think that is cinema. I think other things may happen, particularly with home entertainment, that will involve VR and will involve interactivity. And certainly anyone who knows anything about computer games knows that that stuff is advancing in leaps and bounds. That is probably the emergent art form of the 21st century.
Yeah.
But I think that cinema, which kind of found its feet during the 20th century, will continue pretty much as it is. I was right about 3D.
You were?
I still think that there is a desire to watch films on the big screen in an auditorium with other people in the same way that theatre is watched. People go to art galleries. Yes, you can get the Mona Lisa up on your laptop, but if you go to the Louvre and see it, it's different. And you go, well, it's worse because you're behind a crowd and it's tiny, you can't see it, but people still do it.
So what's interesting is that that's very interesting, and I kind of know that's what you think. But I wonder if, so Barbie, for example,
yes,
much more fun if you go and see it with 30 people, and then when you get there, there's 100 other people in there, and you're all having a great time together.
Yeah.
So that Barbie will still be Barbie in 20 years' time.
Yes.
Oppenheimer will still be Oppenheimer because you would still want to see that on as big a screen as possible. Yeah. I guess the issue would be whether the virtual reality set that, let's assume that they're affordable and everyone has them.
They will.
There will be more movies which you go, no, it's fine. I'll watch that at home.
But they won't be movies. Those will be different things. Watching something, I mean, you can watch a movie at home on your television, but I'm talking about, when I'm saying the virtual reality is, I'm saying there's a whole other stream of entertainment which is to do with interactivity, which is probably the emergent art form, which is not, it's not, you know, there is a fixed thing telling you a narrative. It is an interactive narrative.
But what I mean, a film will come out, you will talk about a film.
Yes.
And people will be saying, fine, I'll watch that at home with my VR set.
No, they won't watch it with their VR set. They will watch it at home on a television screen. The VR thing is a whole other form. And this is why I think people make the mistake. I don't think cinema is turning into virtual reality, despite what happened at Cannes a few years ago. I think there are two different art forms there. And I think virtual reality and interactive gaming is emerging and may even take out, may even, you know, outstrip cinema in terms of its popularity. But cinema will still essentially stay as cinema. I think it has reached its apotheosis.
In which case, the movie theatre will be
pretty much the same.
Will be pretty much the same, but will be used for
movies.
Fewer films. There will be.
That's possible. Yeah. I don't know though. Okay. I don't know that it will dwindle. Sorry.
One other thought. Completely different thought. Possibly, if this goes well, that cinema and the production companies will be finding stories that are more diverse than the stories they have been finding.
Yes,
they will
I think
be
that
find.
Is definitely,
there
the
will
case.
Be stories and ideas and characters from communities who haven't.
Yes, I think that is absolutely the case.
That they will be making their own film.
Yes, absolutely. And when you say there'll be fewer things, I think we're only scratching the surface of what's out there now. You know, in any given year in the UK, X hundred movies are made, but around the world, tens of thousands of movies are made that we don't know about. And what may well happen is, I mean, this happened to some extent during the pandemic. I was writing recently about this. I was writing in The Observer that the one weird thing that happened during lockdown and the month between the lockdowns was that because they pulled all the blockbusters out of release, you suddenly found that we'd do a show every week and we'd review 5, 6, 7 movies. And there was one week that we did, every single movie we reviewed was directed by a woman. We didn't even notice when we did it. Why? Because the big trucks had got out of the way and suddenly all this other stuff, which just hadn't been getting any attention, came to the fore.
If you have any questions,
you're right.
I was emotionally disturbed. If you have any questions for us, we would love to get them. correspondence@covenantmayo.com. Also, if you want to pick up on any of these topics, particularly if there are groups of people who you're scared of, I'd just be interested.
Yeah, no,
to know.
I really want to know that.
Yeah, because you might want to share it, you might not want to share it. There might be groups of people who you're scared of you wouldn't say out loud. But anyway, if you got a thought, let us know. correspondence@covenantmayo.com. And if you're thinking, oh, it's not finishing already, is it? Well, there'll be another take one and take two with you in a couple of days.